Washington Paper.
Welcome to episode 68 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the field of hand papermaking and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand papermaking studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. This is part two of a conversation with Nicole Donnelly. If you missed part one, you can find it at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast/Nicole Donnelly. Enjoy our conversation.
And the following year, 2010, I went to the Women's Studio Workshop. I got an artist residency there. I was there for 5 weeks, and it was so wonderful to work in a studio where I had the Reina Beater. I could process high shrinkage flax. All of the projects that I was working on at the Women's Studio Workshop were, 4-hour flax, essentially.
Yeah.
And I had a blast with it. So I was printing onto that paper while it was wet, drying some of it flat, casting some of it over stones, because I think all paper makers at some point cast their sheets of paper over stones. It's a rite of passage.
Yeah. Right.
You build a boat, you wrap some stones. Done. Check. So I returned to Philadelphia after doing that, and I just thought, I absolutely need to continue doing this. I prepared a lot of 4-hour flax and brought it back with me, but that only lasts for so long.
Right.
So, I really started pursuing this idea of creating a papermaking studio that would be community accessible in Philadelphia. And it took me a couple more years to really obtain my first beater, but I got my first Valley Beater literally Christmas of 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas morning, the delivery truck showed up.
Wow.
There had been a blizzard. They were delayed for a day. They were driving. It's a couple of guys who do press and heavy delivery.
Equipment.
And so, they move printmaking presses all the time. They were like, oh, 700-pound beater, no problem. We got that. We've got a delivery in D.C., and then we're headed to Christmas dinner at our folks' place in Massachusetts. We'll just head up the Eastern Coast.
Uh-huh.
See you somewhere in that window. And so I got my Valley Beater at the very end of 2012, and that started paper thinking. So
you blipped out there for a minute. So Paper Think Tank, that's your current studio. Yeah, tell me all about Paper Think Tank, because you do a bunch of things, and it is this community space that you were working towards. Yeah.
Yes.
Kept the vision.
Which right now it's really just me. But, but it's the pandemic.
Yes. Right.
So 2013, I really get the studio up and running, and I'm beginning to offer workshops and classes. And I do a lot of work with invasive species and sustainable hand paper making, because I really believe in that. It's so important to the environment and, mm-hmm. and to the tradition of hand paper making.
Mm-hmm.
Wood pulp was not introduced until the late 1700s, and it's really a huge disservice to the environment and to the craft. But with that said, I have a focus on that in my practice, but also in the work that we do in the studio. What else? we offer classes, and the studio is open to people to come in to make use of the studio space. They can also collaborate with me to make work in paper. So artists who have no familiarity with the medium can work with me to make original artworks or addition to artworks. I've been doing that since 2015.
Mm-hmm.
I've been teaching my sculptural making paper making techniques to other people since 2016. And in 2018, I started partnering with outside institutions so that the Brandywine Workshop and Archives, for instance, which has 40 years of these visiting artist residencies to work with artists in the medium of print, primarily plate lithography, or offset lithography, plate lithography, and screen printing. In 2018, they decided that handmade paper would be amazing to incorporate into their editions. So started partnering with them in 2018. And in 2019, I began also as the master paper maker for the Brodsky Center, which is now at the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts.
Oh, that's right.
No longer at the Rutgers. So I'm wearing a lot of hats these days.
Yeah, you are. And I want to ask, so your original, you talked a while ago about originally going to grad school to become a teacher. And I'm imagining you meant a full-time faculty. Did you ever even try that? Did you apply for any jobs? And then these things that you're doing now, did you instigate them? Or did someone ask you?
I know. So it's, we go and set these intentions in the world, and what happens is something else is totally different often.
Mm-hmm.
So I did go to grad school with the intention of getting my MFA so I could teach in higher ed. And I did want to teach a full-time position, you know, tenure
sure.
would be great. Awesome. But I applied for these positions, and straight out of grad school, no one was hiring me.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved back to Philadelphia. Philadelphia has a lot of universities and colleges.
Right.
That means a huge pool of grad degree students who are all applying for the same small pool of jobs. So I applied, but nothing came through. Okay. I decided I have other skills. I've always had other skills. And living in Mexico actually gave me a lot of entrepreneurial initiative because in Mexico City, no one had money to hire anyone. So essentially what you had to do is go to someone that you could potentially work for and tell them, I can do this for you. I could also do this for you. If you need it, I might be able to do this. And we could think about a project where I do, you know, I work on this website for you and also, you know, organize this piece of your business, which are things that people need done. But, you know, no one is thinking that when they're thinking about hiring. And so in Philadelphia, actually, I think in 2008, the economy crashed, 2009. The arts were suffering. There was no budgeting for the arts. So even these nonprofit organizations that I'd worked for in the past in Philadelphia were not hiring because the state budget was suspended. So there was zero opportunity. And I had to approach people and tell them about myself and what I could do for them and sort of and sell myself and say, like, okay, you could hire me to... I got myself hired as an artist assistant to a sculptor and finally to catalog an art collection also.
I remember visiting that collection. Yeah, you took me around. That was amazing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it's 2,500 prints.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, it's a little mind-boggling. But I got to work with that collection and it was wonderful. And it taught me so much about the history of prints and printmakers that you don't learn in a book. Because these are artists that the collector had a relationship with, various publishers that the collector had a relationship with. So again, Brandywine and Brodsky Center were both collections that or publishers that the collector purchased works from.
Okay.
So, you know, which is not how I got any of the work that I'm doing right now. So, you know, I was doing all of this varied work, and it wasn't until I was actually collaborating with a local artist here in Philadelphia in the studio, making, she's a printmaker and a sculptor, and we were working on a series of pulp paintings for her. So I produce the paper, and she works on it in my studio. So we mix up all the linen pulp paints together, and I mean, it's a color library of 36 colors or something. So we spend an entire day just making those. And it's this beautiful, luscious library of color. I love it. She went to school here in Philadelphia. She was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania at PAFA, which is the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art. And she had mentioned to me, and also a potential intern had mentioned to me, that the Brodsky Center had just moved to the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Art.
Mm-hmm.
So in 2018, the Brodsky Center moved all of their papermaking to PAFA. And Anne McCune, I believe, oversaw the move-in, and she taught a couple of workshops, but she really decided, you know, I'm retiring after this. Mm-hmm. I can be done. Mm-hmm. It's all yours. Have fun with it. So she got to see the move through, but then they didn't have anyone to teach. And spring of 2018, this was maybe, spring of 2018, and my friend Alexis Granwell, who's working with me in the studio, says, you know, PAFA needs to hire somebody to teach papermaking, and you are the most qualified person I know here in the city. Just send an email to the dean. He's the person that you need to talk to. Mm-hmm. So I emailed him, and this is December, which is when they're sort of planning. I mean, they would have already planned the spring semester courses.
Right.
So, you know, and they had just gotten the studio set up. So I wrote to him. He wrote back to me and was like, oh, thank you. You know, we'll be in touch. And I emailed again in February saying, hey, in case you're thinking about it, I could teach workshops at any point.
Mm-hmm.
This is a list of workshops that I teach in my studio, which at that point was, you know, I have 10 different workshops that I teach on a regular basis.
Right.
And, you know, here's this outline of things that I could teach. Here are some full-length courses I could teach. And here's my CV. And again, I gotta thank you very much for this. That's great. We'll be in touch. And then it was May, and I was at PBI, which is the Paper and Book Intensive at Oxbow. Mm-hmm. I was invited to teach there in 2019. So it's maybe day two or day three, and you're in it. You're mm-hmm. taking classes. I wasn't teaching until the second week, thankfully. Mm-hmm. But you're just in the middle of all this wonderful papery book wonder.
Yeah, it's like summer camp for book and paper artists.
Oh,
yeah.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
And I got, you know, you can check email once a day, maybe, if the Wi-Fi is just right. And I got this email from the dean of the school saying, hey, can you come by sometime in the next 2 weeks? I'd like to introduce you to the director of the Brodsky Center. We'll take you on a tour of the facilities. And that was what it said. At no point in our email exchange was there mention of an interview. nothing.
Right.
So, you know, I said, oh, I'm going to be at Oxbow for another 2 weeks, but as soon as I'm back, I'd love to come in and see you. And I went in, and it was very clear that it was a job interview. And but by the end of our meeting, you know, they were like, okay, so, you know, you would be in charge of doing this. It wasn't even a question of, we'll get back to you. It was just like, we're bringing you in. You are going to be the person who does this, if you're okay with that.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, I was shocked and surprised. And it was very interesting that, you know, it took 10 years from the time that I completed my MFA until then that I really got a job in higher ed. And I wasn't pursuing it at all.
Right. And what percentage of your time is that job? Is that
So I really have one course that I teach. I teach one course to full-time students each semester and one continuing ed class. So that's, you know, technically 6 hours of classroom time.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, more than that in preparation. But I have an assistant who does some of that.
Wow.
Not right now because everything's on lockdown and we're all remote, but that's okay. And then my work as the master papermaker for the Brodsky Center really depends on how many projects we get. And moving forward, I believe it's going to be 2 artists per year. So it's sort of 1 artist each semester.
Mm-hmm.
And that looks like 24 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
Or however much time it takes to get it done. So, you know, it does work out to, that can work out to a full-time job. It doesn't quite work out to full-time pay.
Uh-huh.
And it's not salaried. So I know that while it was at Rutgers is the State University of New Jersey, and that was a salaried position.
Okay.
So Anne McCune got to just be there. And CAFA is a very small institution.
Mm-hmm.
It's the oldest art institution in the country. And it's one of only 3 models left that is both a museum and a school.
Mm.
So, you know, it's sort of in this rarefied class, but it's also very small. There's 300 students.
Wow.
It's tiny.
Yeah, yeah. And have you done any artist collaborations there yet?
So we started the first one in February.
Okay.
And we had about a week's worth of in-person meeting. And the first artist is Sarah McGeaney. She's a Philadelphia artist. So in some ways, she's very close by, and it should be easy to collaborate, except that the school isn't allowing anyone on the campus.
Right.
So she wanted to make a paper sculpture of her dog. And we are, I've been working on the mold, so that's what I've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to say that the one really wonderful part of having the Brodsky Center be part of the university is that, or it's a college rather, you have these other resources, like an entire sculpture department.
Right.
It's wonderful.
Yeah.
And it's all right there in the same building.
Right. Right.
So, you know, I just go to a different floor and I go up one to sculpture and I can go
all the tools and equipment at your hands. Yeah. Yeah.
And the ventilation.
Right. Right. Oh, that's amazing. Okay. Yeah. I want to just touch on COVID teaching. Are you teaching papermaking?
Oh yeah, I am.
And how, yeah. So how have you done that?
Yeah. So, papermaking is so material intensive. And, you know, I think because I had set up my own studio practice before I had any of the equipment, my first papermaking setup was in my apartment.
Mm-hmm.
So I had figured out this way of working in a relatively small space to make paper by hand. And, you know, I was just like, okay, if I was able to do that, these students are going to be able to do it. But, you know, everyone's in college.
Right.
What did I not have in college? Oh, I don't know, a blender. That was a rarity.
Yeah.
You know, you borrowed it from the person down the hall.
Uh-huh.
And it was usually used for margaritas. So if you're making paper, you're going to have to clean that out really well.
Yeah.
So I realized that I was going to have to prepare these kits for the students in order for this to be even remotely successful. What I was allowed to do is prepare a pulp for the students. We condensed it, packed that into gallon zip bags. Great. They have a very extensive list of the materials that are absolutely necessary. For the materials that were absolutely necessary, they were also given a list of alternatives that they might have around the house. Mm-hmm. So if you can't buy a concrete mixing tub, one of those black bags, mm-hmm. do you have an under the bed clothes bin?
Right.
You know, can you put a stopper in your sink?
Right.
Maybe you don't want to use the bathtub because everybody else needs to use the bathroom. Because you're in college, you probably share an apartment, or maybe you're back at home with your parents.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to tell you about the Paper Year, which is going online in 2021. This is an annual subscription club, kind of like a year-long online class, featuring a new paper project each and every month. Get inspired with video and written project instructions designed to spark ideas that keep you creating for the rest of the month. Explore creative paper techniques, including origami, pop-ups, paper weaving, book arts, paper cutting, and more. And join our growing community of paper lovers online to learn and share in a warm, encouraging, supportive, creative environment. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com to find out more and hold your spot. Registration opens in late December, and the first project will be delivered on January 4th.
So they had a very exhaustive list of how to do this and the materials that they would need to supply. I gave them pellets and pulp, some colored pulp, pigmented pulp, and...
For the whole semester, you pre-prepared, and you did that in your studio.
I actually did that at the school.
You were able to.
Yeah, so I was allowed to access the studio, but none of the students were allowed to because it's not deemed a large enough space. Mm-hmm. And that was smart, and it's good. So all of their materials were left out in the hallway, and they could just come and pick them up.
And what about the mold and deckle?
Mold and deckle, so important. We have precious few molds, actually, that mm-hmm. made their way over with the Brodsky Center. You know, I think student molds get beat up. And the few that we do have, I want to keep them in good working condition. So I wasn't about to give those out. But another paper maker in Philadelphia who really decided that she was done, she doesn't make sheets of paper any longer, and she doesn't teach any longer. Carol Cole is, you know, probably like early 60s or maybe just about 60. You know, she makes these wonderful mixed media sculptures and she uses paper pulp. She is the person that I acquired my second Valley Beater from. But she decided, you know, I don't really make sheets of paper any longer. I'm not teaching these workshops, but she had taught workshops for years. She had a ton of student molds.
Oh, good.
She gave them all to me last year as a donation. And they're all different sizes. Mm-hmm. So for me to teach workshops in my studio, I thought, these aren't great because I hate when things are all different sizes. Which is my own, you know. But they were all sort of these, like, all slightly different rectangular sizes. And I thought, these are actually perfect to give to students. If they destroy it, it's okay. Mm-hmm. They were donated to me. This is the appropriate cause to give these students these molds.
Yeah, yeah.
So everyone was able to get a mold and deckle. I think, you know, without that, it would have been a whole other, we would have spent 2 weeks just on building molds.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Instead of doing that, we were able to just jump right into making paper. Although, you know, week one was learn how to set up your studio and what mm-hmm. this is going to take.
Right.
Week two, can you continue making paper? Or do you need to drop this class? And that's, you know, and that's a very realistic, it's a very realistic thing,
yeah,
especially for a student, because they really don't have a lot of resources. And paper is patience.
Mm-hmm, for sure. Know?
And this isn't their only class.
Right.
Specifically with my students, this isn't an elective where, you know, they could be at a larger university coming from a different discipline and they want to learn about paper. These are visual artists who are studying sculpture, painting, printmaking. Everything that they're doing is about making. And so to lose the space that you have mm-hmm. for making, to paper making for days at a time is just, you know, probably not realistic. So for this course specifically, I limited the required active paper making to the first half of the semester. So we actually just finished making paper. They aren't required to do it any longer, but they can do it.
Uh-huh.
And what they've learned in this time is how to make sheets of paper, how to restraint dry them in their living situation. Generally, it's drying it onto boards or sheet metal, but they found the seats
surfaces
of metal chairs.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Seats of metal chairs works well. those were the flattest sheets of paper I've seen. And then letting them air dry. And of course, everybody wants to make sculpture now. But we worked through embedding and inclusions, working with stencils to incorporate imagery and incorporating colors. So they've actually gotten some really great results. And I'm very proud of them and the resourcefulness they've shown. And we did get to reference a couple of your books in the class.
Oh,
so thank you for being such wonderful resources.
Oh, my pleasure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And how is your face-to-face, like, how is a class conducted? How many students do you have? And you're on Zoom?
Right, we're on Zoom.
Are you doing a demo, and are they doing the same thing, or do you just show something?
Water and electronics don't mix. It's so tough. So I do have a good setup for demoing during class. But what I've found really is that the video quality of Zoom during a live conversation is really very poor.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is a very subtle art form.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't convey that when the image resolution is low.
Right.
So I pre-recorded all of the demos.
Okay.
At my studio with my phone and my tripod.
Mm-hmm.
And those are broken up into anywhere from 2 to, I think the longest is probably 14 minutes. And it's a series of 10 or so videos that walk them through all of the steps that we've done. There's 5 just for the intro to paper making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, this is how to do all of these things and this is what you're trying to do.
Yeah.
So they are required to watch those videos outside of class time. Our active class periods are limited to 60 to 90 minutes. And that's really to discuss the work, discuss challenges so that they can talk to each other and learn from each other and learn mm-hmm. about how they've each, you know, solved various issues mm-hmm. that they're trying to work on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I give them lectures. So it's a lot of lectures on my part, but I think it's also good to sort of develop those resources too. Because we have been going deeper into discussions about craft. We've been going deeper into discussions of, you know, the reinvigoration of hand paper making in the U.S. And how its transition, you know, from Dart Hunter into Douglas Howe, essentially, like how that craft form transitions into an art form and how the art practice has really preserved that.
Right. Yeah, so interesting.
Yeah. And that we continue to innovate and develop, you know.
Yeah, it's so old and so young at the same time. That's so interesting. I just did a residency. I just did a residency with a group of 6 to 9 year olds in Arkansas. So it was over, we used Google Meets, and they were all in the classroom together. So they are in school, and it was interesting because I was actually demoing in my studio, and then they were doing what I said, and we figured out it was 10 days. So we figured out over time how to have the kids all together while I demoed, and then they went to their own stations, and they each had a laptop, so I could see.
Wow. Yeah,
it took me like a week to realize, oh, I could pin each student and actually look at them big. I didn't know that at first. So there's all the technology things. You're like, oh shoot, I was trying to look at 16 of them on a screen and like see this one making paper and comment on it. It's definitely not perfect. Nothing like being in person, but there's a lot you can do.
And the students, I mean, my students in particular said, you know, we prefer to watch the demo and then have this be more of a conversation and not try to mix technology and water at the same time. And, you know, I think in a lot of classrooms, you have access to technology in a way where each student can have their own laptop or tablet.
Right.
But
if they're at home,
these college students, I have one student who really only has their phone. I have written assignments. They have to give a presentation. And I know that this one student only has their phone. And, you know, I know that they're not going to be able to do the assignment, but so far they haven't reached out to me and I need to reach out to them.
Yeah. But they all have internet. I mean, because that could be an issue as well. Okay, we got to zip through. You're the president of IAPMA. You have been for many years. Tell us about the organization and just a little bit.
IAPMA is the International Association of Pan Paper Makers and Paper Artists. And it was founded in 1986 in Düren, Germany by a rather large number of international paper artists. So they had all met each other, gathered there, and this organization really is dedicated to promoting paper art. And in contrast to the national organization, which is the North American Hand Paper Makers, we have a focus on paper art, but that means that it is open to people working with industrially made papers, handmade papers that they have not made themselves, who are manipulating those papers to create two-dimensional and three-dimensional works and book works and other things like that. It's an organization with almost 600 members from 44 different countries. And, you know, I'm really just, it's very humbling and inspiring to be the president of the organization because it's really a lot of work, but it's also just such an incredible opportunity to learn about what role paper plays in many different cultures.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional forms of paper craft and paper art, because, you know, in the U.S. we have this very Western-centric perspective, which is based in Western craft, Western art history, and we really overlook these other traditional craft forms which have existed for centuries, millennia.
Right.
So it's, you know, we offer a biennial conference called the Congress. The next one hopefully will be in Japan. It's been postponed due to the pandemic. If the Olympics happen, hopefully we can also have the Congress. But that's all up in the air.
Yeah.
We have one annual publication that's full color print with handmade paper covers. And we welcome people from, you know, all over the world, and try to make it promote paper art We host exhibitions of paper art. We give out micro grants to members to organize projects that are centered on the promotion of paper art, whether that's exhibitions, mail art exchanges, artist book exchanges. We have a lot of programs that have moved online because of the pandemic, that are, you know, more virtual than real, but that's resulted in some video documentary projects as well, which is great because I think probably your project was the first video documentary project that IAPMA had given any funding to, and I don't know if that was a completely happy arrangement in the end, but I, you know, I know that you were.
This is another thing I forgot about. Project. The Papermaker Studio Guide was contributed to. Cool.
That's IAPMA.
Yeah.
6 years as president.
6 years. Oh, amazing. Amazing. Okay. And I know we didn't talk about some of your work, your environmental work and outdoor installations, but we need to wrap up. So I'll post links to your website and, but let's just talk about a couple of recommendations you had. So you, do you listen to music when you're in the studio? Cause you sent me a couple of.
I do. I tend to always, if I don't have the radio on, you know, I'll listen to music on the radio. And I listen to a lot of news, but it's, that can be overwhelming and it influences things too much. So you need to calm down sometimes. And I've been a big fan of the Concierto de Aranjuez, which is based around this guitar melody that's just truly beautiful. And it, I think the one that I sent you is Jim Hall's recording of that. There are several recordings, but that one is really pretty phenomenal. And especially, in a time of really trying to process loss, it's very meditative and calming.
Wonderful. And you've been reading a lot during the pandemic. Maybe you read a lot already. You said you've journaled since you were 10, so you write and read, and I don't do either.
Oh my god.
So I'm jealous.
But, I never get to read. It's only, I mean, I think I just buckled down in March, you know, and it was such a pleasure. It was just so thrilling to be able to sit and read. And also, I inherited a Kindle from 2012 that required 4 software patch updates before it would talk to the internet. But I've just been downloading books from the library, which is great. So, you know, my library has this wonderful app that they use called Libby. And I've had a lot of books on my list, including some that are I have meant to read and never read, like Moby Dick, and I'm just over halfway through. And there's just, I mean, it's wonderful in that I really think it's meant to be read chapter by chapter because it's very anecdotal. And there's descriptions that are so visually rich because Herman Melville spent months at sea. There is, you know, there's a lot about the meditative qualities about being at sea that I think is really wonderful. And especially during these really turbulent political times, you know, I've been reading a lot about, you know, Stamped from the Beginning is also on my list, and Wyatt Tumor's, I'm sorry, I just lost the title of the book. The Dragon, the Giants, the Women.
Yes.
Yes. That,
Wyatt Tumor.
That book is so, it's so touching. And it's a very traumatic recounting of Civil War. But to read that in parallel to where we are as a nation and to think about it's about the Civil War of Liberia, but Liberia has a very complicated history of the United States.
Right.
And it did lead me down this rabbit hole of learning about the history of Liberia, which is fascinating. And I think it's always very interesting to read a historical account or a more objective account after reading a fictionalized account, even though it is very, very much based on her own experience of war as a child.
Right.
So it's a fictionalized memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's very powerful. Very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. And tell me about the 4K HD YouTube slideshow videos of Fine Art.
Oh yeah. They're amazing. So, you know, you can put on any soundtrack you want, but if you miss museums and art, there are, and you have a high resolution flat screen TV, that's sort of a requirement for this to get the most out of the experience. But if you've got that flat screen, these 4K HD slideshows, people have been putting together fine art slideshows that are these super high resolution photographs of artwork. So the Van Gogh.
I looked at that. Yeah.
Oh, it's just amazing. Like, it's so stunning. And the paint is so buttery and beautiful.
Yeah. And it goes right to the edges of your screen.
Oh my gosh.
I didn't look at it on my TV yet.
Right.
Yeah.
But even just on your computer screen, you're like, oh my God, you can't even believe that the image quality is so good. So those are, some of them are 3 and 4 hours.
Wow.
And I could just, you know, especially at the beginning of the pandemic, it was wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like a James Turrell Sky piece. Experiencing just this. I don't even watch the Van Gogh for very long.
Right.
Does it change? Do they change subtly? Yes. Yeah. They change subtly.
Some of them do.
And so you're just listening and watching. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just this, it's a great, I mean, I could just sit there and drink coffee and think about that, you know, because going to a museum was just not a luxury that there was any way to afford.
Right. Yeah.
And I think it's so important when you're a maker and putting things out in the world to remember to put things back in.
Absolutely. And you do forget. I forget. And then when I go to a museum or I see something, I'm like, oh my God, I have been missing that input. Yes. Yes. Yeah.
And it really nourishes you.
Mm-hmm. It does for sure. Okay. And then tell me about this Chinese professor project about papermaking in China.
Yes. So a couple of years ago, I went to China for the first time in 2017. I met Professor Tang then, and on meeting him, I thought, oh my God, Tim Barrett has a Chinese doppelganger. Not because they look like each other, but they are so similar in just how focused and methodical and scientific. Professor Tang is not a papermaker. Himself, really. In that way, they're different. But he has completed a study. He's, of course, continuing to find more papermaking villages as he goes. But he had made it his mission to study and document every papermaking village in China that is still practicing traditional hand papermaking.
Wow.
All across the country. And China, when we think about it, we think, okay, China, it's huge.
Mm-hmm.
It is as wide as the United States. It occupies a massive amount of territory, and it has 1 billion people.
Right.
This is an enormous project. He's created an interactive map. His university in Anhui has an archive of paper samples, fiber samples, documentation about the tools and equipment that each place is using and the types of paper that they make. He published a book last year, which is a huge tome from what I've seen. And I so hope that it will get translated.
Mm.
that is, I mean, that is just something that I would be so interested to read. But also I was hoping to go visit him at his university and visit his collection this year. But of course, that wasn't possible.
Yeah.
So well, hopefully sometime in the future.
Yeah, hopefully. Okay, and just to wrap up, Nicole, where can we find you online?
You can find me online at www.paperthinktank.com. And my personal artist website is www.nicole-donnelly.com.
That's two N's and two L's.
Yes.
and you're on Instagram links, too.
Yes. Nicole.donnelly.art. Mm-hmm. And if you Google Nicole Donnelly and you find something about baby legs, that's not me. There is a blonde Nicole Donnelly who gets very angry if you contact her. Also an entrepreneur, but yeah.
not the artist.
Not the artist.
Okay. Well, thanks for sharing your life with paper with us, Nicole.
Oh my
it's been
gosh,
great having
thank
you on.
You so much.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at helenhebertstudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Red Cliff Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert Studio. You can sign up at helenhebertstudio.com. to receive my e-newsletter. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed it, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps other people find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit helenhebertstudio.com and click on Paper Talk, where you can find out more about them, subscribe to the series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. I'll talk to you soon.
The reason, besides the season.